Welcome to the Fulham Only Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 6:17 British Summer Time. Well, this being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And today I'll start off with what's been going on in the markets today. And I suppose the main news story that we've seen today has been that you've had some job figures came out in the US. They were a little bit worse than expected. So that has really fed into this yo-yo effect on expectations for interest rates, because they weren't as good as expected. They think interest rates aren't going to go up as much anymore. So you've had a rally in the bond markets. Excuse me. But the other side of that is that because the economy is a little bit weaker, the equity markets haven't been doing particularly well. And the fact that the equity markets haven't gone up on this news is interesting, because they've been moving on interest rates pretty much all week. And as I said, this really is sort of a yo-yo effect. It's like every single day the market is changing its mind on which way interest rates are going to go. The chances are that interest rates are not going to go very much higher, purely because we're getting back into the average price that we were in prior to this relatively long period of softening of interest rate policy. And now the tightening again. I think the average rate, the interest rate between sort of 94 and 99 was around between 5 and 6 and a bit. So we're definitely getting back into that area right now. But the market is still very nervous about this sort of thing, so any sort of interest rate policy is going to rattle it a little bit. There's also the high oil price to bear in mind, because it's nowhere near getting a downward dynamic. It's down a little bit in here today. Oil is currently sitting at 74.70. Spent most of the day over $75. Weakened a little bit in here just recently. Natural gas is weak in here as well. It's down 15 cents. It's at 5.51 in here. So definitely, well, it's conclusively broken through that $6 support, and continuing to look weak. But that ratio of oil to natural gas is making natural gas look remarkably cheap in here, and it's only a matter of time before that starts to pick up again. Although holding it in the short term, or in for me possibly even in the medium term, is going to be quite a painful business on the long side. On the base metals, nickel really is the star performer, and it's up $345 in here. It was spent quite a bit of time today, over 24,000. It's a bit underneath that now, at 23,895. So still very firm in here. Yesterday had a very good upper dynamic there on copper, but that's pegged back a little bit in here. It's down 670 at the moment, so it's maintaining most of the gain it had yesterday. But coming off a little bit in here. So it'll be interesting to see how much that softens, given that we've had that really good upward dynamic there yesterday. On the precious metals, they're a little bit softer in here today, so not following through on the good action we saw yesterday. Gold is currently down 35 cents on the spot, and just over $2 on the future. It's currently sitting at 632.67. Silver's down a little bit. It's down 16.5 cents at 11.42. The high of the day was at 11.62. So, really, it's holding up really quite well, particularly having broken above that $11 level last week. Then, looking at the equity markets, the Asian markets were relatively quiet in here. The Nikkei was down only 13 points. Hang Seng was up just a little bit, and Australia was up just a little bit too. There was good action in New Zealand, so that's broken the short-term downtrend in New Zealand, and that hasn't come off particularly much, really, in this sort of medium-term correction we've seen across asset class, particularly equities, in the last 6 or 7 weeks. So New Zealand is looking pretty okay. In Europe, markets were closed relatively unchanged. They've jumped around quite a bit today, particularly with that jobs news in the US. But the FTSE was down one, so relatively unchanged. DAX down quarter of a point. Again, very little happening there. It's a bit more interesting in the US today, because the Dow is down 100 points right now, nearly 1%. S&P is down just a little bit, and the Nasdaq's down another 11 points. That Nasdaq 100, I posted that chart, I think, three or four days ago. It had that good upward move, hasn't been able to hold it, and it's coming back into that very short-term progression of rising lows. It'll be interesting to see whether those hold or not next week, because if it moves to a lower low, that's going to panic quite a lot of people, I reckon. On the other hand, we are probably more than 50, well, we're almost certainly more than 50% of the way through, I'd say maybe possibly three quarters of the way through on the downside, how much we're going to go in this medium-term correction. On the other hand, how far it's come down is one factor. The next factor is how long is it going to take to get back up to those highs, and that's probably going to take longer than it did to come down. It's certainly not going to go up as fast as it came down, which means that this medium-term correction could last easily throughout the summer and possibly into the autumn. And the chances are that we're going to see some really rather boring activity coming through in the next couple of weeks, where people will just become less interested with the equity markets, and the chances of us seeing 1 and 2% moves continually is going to get less and less as time goes on, I think. The bond markets are up a little bit. Well, they're up quite a bit in here today. Treasuries are up 24 points at 106.31, so they bounced a little bit off the bottom of the range there. So they're probably go have a look at the top side of the range, which is around 108. It would really need a conclusive break of 108 to show that this was a bottoming out, and I'm quite doubtful that's going to happen. And well, in here today you've had pretty much a rally across the board on the government bond markets. But moving on to our sort of bigger picture themes, and we think that the US, after the Nasdaq bubble, is in a secular bear market. And that's long defined here as a generational long period of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields. And if you put in dividend yield into the search engine and just have a search around, you'll see plenty of charts that we've posted of dividend yields, particularly in the US. And that really does look like a base. That, in fact, it's broken out of the base, so we've got starting to get rising yields. When at the bottom of the last bear market, the S&P was yielding over 6%, and today it's significantly lower than that. So, I think the yield is 1.87% on the S&P. So it's only a quarter of where yields were 20 years ago. What this tells us is that the chances of us seeing massive growth in the US stock market is really quite slim. Now, a lot of people have looked at the way the markets moved throughout the 70s, where the Dow Jones had a glass ceiling around, I think, about 1,000. And people are asking, well, is that going to happen again? And the question, of course, the answer is we don't know. But what we can be relatively sure of is that we're not going to see the kind of explosive growth in valuations that we saw back in the 90s with the Nasdaq. That period for the US markets is probably over. And the main reason that we'll be looking at US markets is for sentiment. Because one thing that we often talk about is the Wall Street leash effect. And that is, when the US is steady to rising, that allows liquidity and investment to flow out from the US. And that is obviously still the largest market in the world. I think it's $4 out of every $6 in the whole world resides in the US. So when the US is steady to rising, that allows liquidity to flow out and investment to flow out to the rest of the world. And high beta developing markets will accelerate on the upside, and they will perform remarkably well. However, when the US is falling or contracting and liquidity is getting pulled back in, those high beta markets are going to get pulled back significantly. And that's what we've seen in many markets in the last 6 to 7 weeks. And good examples of that would be Colombia. I mean, a lot of US investors were looking at South America. Colombia had some relatively good stories about the political situation starting to improve there. A lot of people went in. The local market the retail market in Colombia got involved, and they've had an incredible crash. And you can see charts from there in the chart library. That's one of the worst performing stock markets since this medium term correction started. Another market would have been the Icelandic crown, or krona, where not so much versus the dollar, but versus the euro, it has depreciated really quite significantly, and they raised interest rates yesterday in an effort to stem the tide. But what the main point is that, I mean, no one is really looking at Colombia or looking at the Icelandic krona as major signals, but these are small markets that are high beta and can be influenced very quickly by changes in global liquidity. So when we saw those starting to come off, and we knew that the risks had already been rising of a medium-term correction, those were good signals that this was what was going to happen. And we've been looking for a medium-term correction for quite a while. So what we can expect in the long term is for the US to do pretty okay. We certainly don't think there's going to be a crash, and we don't think this is going to be anything more than a medium-term correction today. Nor do we expect the US to accelerate on the upside or to really put in world-performing stock market growth, because following the bubble of the bursting of the Nasdaq bubble, that has psychologically scared off a generation of investors in US stocks. And they're going to be very slow to come back into the market. And until you have the retail market really involved in your the domestic retail market really involved in the stocks, you can't have the kind of bubble that the Nasdaq saw. Now, Japan, on the other hand, their bubble popped 16 years ago. So there has been a massive grinding water torture bear market in Japan, where the entire population just deserted their domestic stock market, and it was held together by the cross holdings and by foreign investors. Now that's starting to change, and because of the recapitalization of the banks or the reformation of the banks in 2003, we've had that very good rally. It broke out of its base back in August last year. It's starting to form that first step above the base in here right now, and we would say that bear market is over. So we don't know how high the Nikkei is going to go, but we can say with pretty good certainty that the Nikkei is going to retest its all-time highs well before the Nasdaq retests its highs. So that is just a very simple way of looking at the potential that we see in Japan. Obviously, we don't think that's going to happen in 2006 or indeed 2007, but over the long term, the chances of the Nikkei going back up to retest those highs is much better than the Nasdaq retesting its highs. Now, the two main themes that we have for investing on a global basis is supply and elasticity meets rising demand and emerging markets. And they're not mutually exclusive. Because of the massive demographic shift and globalization that we've seen in emerging markets. We now have 5.5 billion people in emerging markets who aspire to our standard of living, and they will do whatever it takes to get it. Once a man, or a woman for that matter, gets a car, they're not going to want to give it up. So the chances of those markets reverting back to walking around and bicycles once they start to automate is really very, very slim. And because of that, the amount of infrastructure that has to be built, the amount of employment that has to be created, the demand for natural resources is booming. And even though we are in the throes of a medium-term correction in many resources, the fact that growth in emerging Asia in particular and in the Middle East is going to set to continue to grow for the next 20 to 30 years, and the fact that they have enormous young populations which will be entering the workforce really quite soon, means that those countries are under enormous pressure to create employment. They're under enormous pressure to create education and to build cities, because this is the greatest urbanization in the history of mankind. in the history of humanity. So that means that anything that it takes, that is needed to build, is going to go up in value. The fact that for the last 20 years, industrial resources have been in an grinding bear market was an absolute nadir as regards trying to run one of these companies. As Donald Cox says, those who love or know most about it love it least. And the number of people working in that industry was declining continually. So we have, on one side, we have the growing demand, but it's the supply inelasticity that will keep prices high for longer. One of the things that really struck me about the whole Inco saga, with so many big companies bidding for Inco, and then Falcon Bridge, and Xstrata getting in there, and Phelps Dodge getting in there, what we're seeing is that these big companies are much happier to go out and buy another company than they are to invest in greenfield sites. Because with a greenfield site, it takes a long time to get it up and running, and by the time you've got it up and running, it's not at all certain whether the demand will still be there, which means that they're holding back on developing those big greenfield sites. It means that for mergers and acquisitions is going rampant in the mining sector, but what it also means is that we're not getting any new supply coming into the market. And mines are a depreciating asset. Once you start mining, you're never going to have as much as the day you weren't mining. Which means that as time goes by, they're going to have to start putting more and more money into building up greenfield sites or brownfield sites. And at the moment, that doesn't appear to be happening to any great extent. And I wonder, is it even happening to an extent that they're covering what's already been taken out of the ground? So that means that industrial resources are going to go up, and they're going to stay up for considerably longer and probably go higher than any of us have really thought about. Now, the acceleration that we've seen recently, particularly in things like copper and zinc, were truly spectacular. But I predict that in 10 or 15 years from now, we're going to look back on those prices and think that they were chump change, to coin a phrase. Because while China is really dominating the headlines in here today, India's population is set to overtake China by 2020. You have 300 million people living in the Middle East. You have Pakistan, Indonesia, Malaysia, all with populations in the hundreds of millions. And the amount of infrastructure and development work that has to be done there just to stay still and to keep the populations happy or non-revolutionary is really quite remarkable. Now, enough about that. The other side of the supply elasticity theme is oil. And when you look at those oil charts, it's in a remarkably consistent uptrend. It's left those long-term highs of $40 well behind, and anyone who thinks that it's going to go back to there anytime soon is really living in, I think, dreamland. But oil is probably the ultimate supply and elasticity commodity, because once you've burned it, there isn't any more of it there. So you can always recycle or metals, but you cannot recycle oil. The chances of I think there are it's I might be wrong on these numbers, but it's pretty close. There's 89 million barrels of oil used a day, which means that for every day they have to find 89 more million barrels of oil just to stay still. And they're nowhere close to doing that. There hasn't been a King field found in something like 30 years. So that means that oil is going to be going up in value, and anything that can substitute oil is going to be becoming more and more viable, which is why natural gas, although it is very cheap today and could possibly get cheaper, it is almost, and I think one of the main reasons that you do have this disconnect is because natural gas is a local market to the US as opposed to oil, which is a truly international commodity. I presume that is going to change in the long term as liquefied natural gas becomes more of an option. So you have supply elasticity meets rising demand. That's certainly one of our biggest theme, and coupled with emerging markets, where we think growth in stock markets is most certainly going to come from, and that obviously stems from the demographics and the growth potential. You also have the spread of democracy, which often goes hand in hand with capitalism, which really does help stock markets. But the other major theme that we have here are rising government bond yields, because one of the things that has really helped stock markets over the last 20 years is the fact that government bond yields have been coming down. And generally, when yields are coming down and it's cheaper to borrow money, it's that really feeds into stock markets. Well, unfortunately, that trend appears to have ended. And it does look like we're moving into a period of rising government bond yields. And that is an incrementally increasing headwind for stock markets. Now, government bond yields aren't going to go up in a linear fashion, and the chances are that we're going to see rolling waves where coupled with inflation, where central banks will be, where inflation will have come, made its way into the public consciousness, and central banks will have to be seen to do something about it, so they'll rise interest rates. But of course, that will also cause the stock markets to fall off, and it will hurt housing markets, and it'll hurt bond prices. And once they have any opportunity to say that they've at least made a partial victory over inflation, then they'll start to steady up, and they'll steady off, and they'll start to lower interest rates as soon as we see any real trouble. And that's what we can expect if they continue to raise interest rates, and if there's any chance that they actually cause a recession. Now, I don't think that's going to happen, but we can't rule out the fact that central bankers make mistakes just like anybody else. If they do cause a recession, they're going to slash interest rates, and that will set the stock market up for one incredible rally. But I'm not predicting that anytime soon. But it will certainly happen at some point in the future. Now, the fact that central bankers are raising interest rates is coupled with the fact that they've been printing money like there's absolutely no tomorrow. And the reason for this was, first, you had the Asian financial crisis, you had the Russian debt default, you had long-term capital management, you had the Nasdaq bubble bursting, you had 9/11, and every time these things have happened, they have pumped in extra liquidity. And every time that has happened, they've devalued the dollar. Now, you'll see some of the charts that I posted during the week that obviously the Fed don't produce the M3 anymore. And while they were producing it, you could see that M3 was growing at a pace that far outstripped GDP growth. And when you look at the Eurozone, the Eurozone, they're printing money, I think at 8.9% per annum, but the GDP is only at about 1 or 2%. So they're producing four times more euros than the economy is producing. And I think that the Euro M3 is a pretty good proxy for what's going on in the US, simply because with the enormous amount of outstanding debt that the US has in current account deficits and capital account deficits, they're printing money to pay bills. And because of the competitive nature of globalization, and no country wants a strong currency, it means that for every dollar that the US prints, if the Eurozone or Great Britain or Switzerland or Japan don't want their currencies to strengthen beyond all recognition, they're going to have to print as well just to even the balance. So when you have the Eurozone printing at 8.9%, there's a very good chance that that's commensurate with what's happening in the US and pretty much everywhere else. Any country that isn't printing money would see their currency appreciate, and appreciate very, very quickly. And because we haven't seen any currency really appreciate very fast, the chances are that all currencies are being, are all central banks are printing money really very, very quickly. What that really means is that we're not going to see a dollar crash, because a dollar crash would would imply that you're going to have a strengthening of just about every other currency, and nobody wants that. So you're going to see a gradual debasement of currencies by central bankers. But because they're all doing it at the same time, it's going to be very difficult to notice. One very easy way to notice it is going to be to look at how gold performs relative to all those other currencies, and you can find those in the chart library as well. Because if you have every currency appreciating relative to gold, it shows us that investors are looking to gold as a store of value. Now, you might ask, why do they use gold? Well, gold is immutable, doesn't rust. So the amount of gold that you have today, you'll have the exact same amount in 100 or 1,000 years' time. And it's always been seen as a store of value, increasingly so with silver, platinum, and palladium. But gold really is the biggest market, and it's certainly the most liquid of the commodities outside of oil. So gold is on an upward path, and although we are still within this medium-term correction, this is probably going to be peanuts compared to what gold is going to see at its peak, where it's almost certainly going to see gold multiply from its current values. So that means that with rising government bond yields and with governments pumping liquidity into the system, now liquidity is finding its way into many different areas, but it's certainly finding its way into the commodities, which is why we had that acceleration back in sort of March, April, which ended at the beginning of this medium-term correction. But while that liquidity is currently getting pulled in a bit, which would explain the medium-term correction, and not just by Japan, I think all governments are taking their foot off the gas pedal a little bit in here to take the froth off the market, particularly the housing market. But they're still printing quite a lot of money, and there might be tightening up credit, but there's still a lot of money floating around in the system. So we have lots of liquidity flowing out there. We currently have rising interest rates. We probably won't see those interest rates fall back to 2% in the US, but next time they start to cut, they'll probably cut them a bit more than people expect, but they certainly won't go back to those lows, I think. But what this really means is that stock markets are going to perform very well in expansionary times, and they probably won't come back really very, very much. We're not going to see a crash, purely because central banks simply cannot allow that to happen, and they'll do whatever it is in their power to make sure that those things don't happen. But the corrections can be swift, and they will be painful. But I don't think there's going to be any kind of Armageddon, and I think there's plenty of people out there looking for a crash in the US dollar. I don't think that's going to happen either. There's plenty of reasons why it could happen, but the fact that no other current country wants it to happen, and we simply can't afford for it to happen, means that it probably won't happen. And the end of the world has been predicted far too many times for it to be a reliable indicator. But with that cheery thought, I'll leave you go. I think David will be back in on Monday, and thank you very much for your support. And if there's anything at all we can help you out with, don't hesitate to contact us. And thank you for your time.